Cassie McCullough, and this is Common Knowledge, RN's weekly survey of popular culture sensations and obsessions.
And I'm Jason DiRosso. And today, have you ever suspected that your taste, your decisions, your desires are being manipulated without you even realising it? Trend forecasting and the dark arts of manufacturing cool coming up.
And also today, Generation Y turns on itself after Kate Miller-Heidke's appearance on Q&A.
Yeah, the treasurer. Wasn't he voted the best treasurer in the world or something? Wayne Swan?
The Brisbane singer was slayed on Twitter for her performance on ABC's Q&A this week, but was it really a glimpse into the deepening chasm that is Australia's generation gap?
That's today on Common Knowledge. Gee, that was almost a train wreck.
It was pretty funny, wasn't it? Pretty lame performance if you were watching it live. You could tell she was dying a death after a number of responses to Tony Jones's questions like
she
that.
She just didn't seem prepared at all. But can we blame her?
Well, look, you know, the backlash on Twitter was ferocious, and the worst of it came from the former Australian Idol contestant Anthony Kalea, who called her an embarrassing representative for Generation Y. Now, you know, that's harsh.
Is he fishing for an invite to Q&A maybe? Maybe he'd be a better better representative of that generation. Look, I don't even believe in Gen Ys and Gen Xs and all that, but look, he's invoked this group name. I actually think that, look, it was probably a little bit unfair to invite her in the first place, but she's obviously plugging an album or, you know, basically trying to promo herself at the moment.
Look, she's been on the show before and she didn't actually have a good time the first time around. It was only about 6 months ago. But they invited her back and she wrote a piece for a website called themusic.com.au a couple of days later, saying that she'd agonised over the decision of whether to go back on, but was told that there'd be quite a number of questions that would suit her. But her disquiet grew when she found out a lot of the show was going to be about the HSU and Craig Thompson and Labor and the RBA's decision on interest rates and the budget. So, look, I think she was hard done by because there really wasn't much room for her to move. And, in fact, she fought back quite well. Have a listen to this bit.
Kate Miller-Heidke, what does this argument about banks and mortgages mean to you?
I just tuned out for a little while. But I have to say, though... the thing is that, like, we hear all the time about interest rates and I'm a musician, nearly all of my friends are musicians, and the truth is that they couldn't even get a mortgage if they wanted one. And I think there's a lot of people out there that couldn't even imagine the day where they could afford a deposit for a house, let alone bitching about mortgage interest rates. So that's my perspective.
Yeah, so she's really, you know, having a go at the agenda of the show, saying
it's a fair enough comment.
Isn't relevant to me or my generation. And if they're going to invite people on to, you know, and she's sure she's got an album to promote, but she's also gorgeous and, you know, ticks the Generation Y box. Mm. Then they have to actually address what she wants to say and what her interests were. It's supposed to be about democracy in action and encouraging people to engage with politics and society,
really,
but they're not listening to the people they've invited on.
Yeah, well, Q&A is becoming less and less. Or was it ever a discussion?
I don't know.
It's just a head clash, really.
No, it is great. I just think here what we're really seeing is probably
a rupture. I mean, she's come. What we're seeing is her come on and totally, as you say, not respond to their agenda and kind of be... just, you know, she doesn't have an opinion on some of these things. Or her lack of opinion is, in fact, her contribution.
Well, you know, she said she wanted to talk about other things like refugees and marriage equality, and she had a whole agenda that she wanted to talk about as well as singing, and the opportunity never came up.
But I love awkward silences in a show like this. I love the fact that someone can kind of, you know, everyone's encouraged these days to go on these shows and have this ready-made opinion about anything and everything.
Yeah, and you can hear a politician droning on about something any hour of the day where, you know, if you turn on the right channel, there'll be someone giving a very polished version of an opinion.
And she reintroduced the notion, the really important notion, that it's okay at any given time to just stop and go, you know what, I don't know. I don't have an opinion on this. And in fact, I don't even care. That's really important, I think, within this 24-hour, 24/7 cycle of news commentary. And I guess we're part of that. Who knows?
Yeah, that's great. But, you know, she responded to Anthony Kalea's tweet by the next day saying on Twitter, pot, kettle, F-wit. to him, which sparked another war of all her supporters sending hate tweets to him, to which he replied, "The one thing I've learned on Twitter is that if you have an opinion and you're not all love and peace and mung beans, you get hate tweet." So there you go. He got paid back as well. Although, interestingly, as a little footnote, it turns out there was a little spat between these two about 7 years ago. And
They've got form.
They do have form, and it turns out it was John Safran who unearthed it. He sent Kate Miller-Heidke a tweet saying, "Do you have some sort of fighting history with him, or did that come out of nowhere?" To which she replied, "I'd forgotten it, but there was a slightly snarky reference to him in one of my old songs." So, feud. So what she'd written in this song was a sort of passing mention to Kalea in the song called Career Advice. She says, "I flipped to Channel 10 and before I knew it, I was watching a really short guy singing that really annoying song by Craig David." So there you go, bit of history behind that stout. But can I just also say in her defence...
Speaking of annoying songs...
after she'd had this quite awful experience, and you could see from her face that she was really having a hard time, she went and did this quite amazing performance of her song Sarah.
I didn't mean to let you down, but you left me on my own, Sarah.
It's kind of great.
It's a very bizarre song. It's about losing your friend at the Big Day Ale.
Something like that.
Yeah.
And you can see she's a classically trained singer. And
Look, it was fine. Very odd, I found it. But, you know, it's not my sort of taste and it doesn't really matter.
Well, to come out of a spat like that and sing like that, I think she, I rate her.
You're listening to Common Knowledge, RN's weekly take on pop culture. I'm Jason DiRosso, and with me is co-host Cassie McCullough.
Now, Jason, one of the things that we've noticed we keep returning to on this program is the idea of a quest for authenticity. It seems to come up in a range of conversations we've had on all kinds of different topics, and we got to thinking that maybe it's actually what's called in the trend forecasting industry a macro trend, that it's actually a sort of abstract concept that's driving ideas in fashion, music, even gadgets, food.
Yeah, popular culture on television. It's very uncool to be fake or prepackaged, or everyone everywhere seems to want to go back to, as their kind of kernel of justification, authenticity.
Mm. So what we decided to do was bring in someone who works with the trend forecasting industry on a daily basis. And so with us is Suzanne Boccolate, creative director of communications company Boccolate. G'day, Suzanne.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Now, this kind of research, trend forecasting, it's done by companies all over the world in different parts of the industry, as I said, fashion, or it could even be economics or movie making, Jason. Mm. So where does it intersect with what you do?
Well, it intersects because we tend to look to that for our clients. We are actually quite interested in, because one of our I suppose, basis of what design and what communications is grazing culture, and finding out what's hot and what's not, and working out what our clients need that to make them sell more or to be noticed.
So right there is the chicken and egg dilemma, isn't it? Because to be able to communicate with those people, you in turn need to know what they're thinking about. So is what consumers or just people like us, is what we're thinking about driving trends, or are we being led by people who have seen what we're fascinated with and have figured out a way of throwing it forward?
Well, I think it's both. I think that we've always had marketing people. I think they've always been around, and they've always been looking at what we love and what we don't love. I think it's become more of an industry potentially. You know, there's the two that I know quite well are the Future Laboratory from London, or the Lee Idlecourt, the Dutch forecaster, who's been around. I mean, she's in her 60s and she doesn't get many things wrong. So that's what she says. And, you know, I've been to lots of those sort of events and they're incredibly compelling.
These are like conferences where you have to sort of pay to attend.
You pay and they're visually spectacular. Future Laboratory, they wear lab coats, and you feel like you're part of this secret club. And they actually look at trends. They've got these little influencers that are sitting in all different countries and they feed information back.
So these are actual people that are that have their ear to the ground, as it were?
Well, some of them, I'm not sure exactly if they're, some of them are employed by them, but they're also, if you're interested in it, like for someone like me, I'm always interested, you know, it's that grazing of culture that I've always been fascinated by. I'm totally interested in what makes people tick and what makes people think.
But so you could also use it for your money. I mean, it's not just a personal interest, and that's what most people would be subscribing to these services for. It's a it's a function of their, well, creative process, which ends up ultimately in a retail environment or in a...
Yep, like a great example of that is the pop-up shop. You know, we saw them coming up. Originally, if you think about the pop-up, it was because rents were getting dear, people couldn't afford them anymore. And so they had these empty shops and people were saying, well, I can take it for a week and do something. And they'd go, great, give me some money, the retailers, so that we can afford to run this shop. They'd come in and do stuff. Now, that was just retailers thinking cleverly. And now it's been taken over by massive corporates. So you're getting sort of alcohol companies and...
Well, Woolworths was recently doing it at train stations, little pop-up kind of displays.
And getting back to that term about authenticity, it's like, and then do people become suspicious of the pop-up? Suddenly it's fun and then we get bored with it and we're like, oh, God, now corporates are doing it. So it's, do you know what I mean? Like, it's
so the macro trend of the search for authenticity is actually sort of eating the very industry that might have identified it.
Yeah, I suspect so.
So what evidence do you see of this idea of authenticity in what you've read in trend forecasting in the last few months?
Oh, God, everything's about authenticity. I think we're all demanding it more and more. I mean, the example I think of is that new Nike campaign that was out, the run.
So that was a Nike campaign which almost, well, it seemed to be influenced by social activist, feminist social activist campaigns of recent years and, well, going back decades as well. It was kind of a reclaim the night theme, wasn't
it?
Yeah,
I think it's called the She Ran the Night, and it's, you know, it's had... That they went through and they only used Facebook, and I think they did a few sort of street campaigns, but it was pretty minor and it was all word of mouth. And
the idea was that women should be able to use the streets to exercise after dark without fear. So very much on that sort of 70s Reclaim the Night theme, and also the more recent slut walks, I guess, which all around the world.
Reclaim the Night. But it is interesting because ultimately whether it's, you know, is it corporates being authentic or is it corporate selling shoes? So it's kind of that fine line, isn't it?
Between... Well, it's impossible for a corporate to be authentic, surely, when they're channeling this sort of stuff. I mean, I remember last year there was a new Levi's commercial. It was part of a campaign called Go Forth, and they made a TV ad using images of youthful protesters and riot police kind of confronting each other on the streets of Berlin. It tapped into the whole Occupy movement vibe. And it conjured the counterculture, I guess, mood of with the Charles Bukowski poem as the voiceover.
Your life is your life. Don't let it be clubbed into dank submission beyond the watch. There are ways out. There is light somewhere. It may not be much light, but it beats the darkness. Beyond the watch, the gods will offer you chances. Know them. Dig them.
Wow, it's really tapping into a kind of moody, existential...
Yeah, while you've got, as I say, there's one image there of a guy with his arms up in the air confronting riot police. You can see that coming a mile off, though. I mean, if they're tapping into the trend of kind of Occupy Wall Street and all that, that kind of authentic street protest. I haven't seen that ad again, so I don't reckon it went really well.
I've not seen it.
Yeah, well, so, there you go. Well, I showed it to you earlier, but yeah, before then you hadn't seen it, had you?
No.
Though trend forecasting is a lot more subtle than this too. I mean, in terms of the way that corporations gather trends via these trend forecasters and then translate them into, you know, products for sale or whatever, it can be a lot more subtle than that, obviously.
Yeah, look, it's both subtle and it's not. I mean, with something like, you know, having seen Lee Iliquot speaking about fashion, you know, 2 years ago she talked about yellow as the new pink, for instance, and now I'm seeing lots of yellow. But is it in the same way as if I want to buy a red car, you know, do I suddenly see red cars? So I'm not sure. You know, it's an interesting dilemma, and I think that it works both ways. But my questions are, you know, have we lost the kids in the basement sort of discovering new things and sending it out? Are the kids actually still creating punk or something? And I'd say probably they are, but it's about how the corporates are trying to maybe hop in on and get in there early.
Well, young people these days, more than any other generation, I suppose.
Sorry, really... Jason, did you just say young people these days?
I did say young people these days. The young people out there. But they, you know, people are really aware. They're pretty media savvy, aren't they? Are we seeing a backlash? Are people trying to get off the grid, especially newer generations who are trying to create their own scenes or whatever it is?
I think they must. I mean, people are. That's, you know, people are. They must be. Because you'd want to...
You'd hope they are.
Yeah, I think they must be.
Oh, there's no question there's a massive distrust of the man around
and
at the moment.
And that's a Gen Y thing. That's definitely much more Gen Y.
Yeah, and possibly you could argue that most generations go through a stage of it, but it does seem to be very prevalent in our culture. And also in books such, you know, I've seen a book about a woman who turned off all her electrical devices and spent the winter with her family just, you know, playing, I don't know whether you're playing cards. I'm not sure what you do
How
when
authentic.
You turn off. Yeah, in this search for authenticity, this sort of idea of stripping back. And I know that there's something called the new hoboism, which is about completely letting go of the comforts of modern life.
Yeah, that's kind of trending with sort of this new sublime or sublimity that's, you know, looking for the quiet spaces because we're completely bombarded by technology and people are switching off. And that's a big trend at the moment. There's a massive, you know, people are doing lots of meditation, lots of yoga. There's, you know, finding yourself again. Within the sort of the madness of the world.
So the money to be made is out of identifying that trend and then figuring out how that translates to your particular business or your particular product.
And I think that what the trend people that I've always watched, they're almost just letting you know what's happening. Then they're making suggestions about, we all know that retailing's struggling at the moment. That the shops are struggling, so retail is very much online. So you've heard all that sort of trend forecasting. But there's other sort of subtleties about, again, using the example of the meditation and how that's become an industry. But it's about people seeing, like there's a great website called Get Some Headspace and it's teaching people how to meditate but without all the spirituality stuff, really simple techniques. And that's become huge in London where people attend these sorts of things. And you've got, you know, the School of Life in London that are teaching people about life skills that Alain de Botton is running. So you're getting all these...
And he's talked about building temples for secularists, hasn't he? For atheists, I think he's talked
yeah,
about.
Look, so, there's yeah, look, all this sort of stuff that you're seeing out there at the moment that's people are looking for more and more kind of spaces for themselves. And I think as a Western society, we don't have a lot of that space. Religion's kind of on the back burner a bit. So this is clearly a big trend.
And within that trend, there's lots of micro trends.
Yeah, like hotels that, you know, you can see views and, I mean, most hotels you can see views, but there are micro trends here within. It's very interesting.
Hotels, yes, but also the idea of last chance tourism.
Yeah,
like people are like sort of rushing to see the Barrier Reef or, you know, parts of Cambodia and Cambodian temples that are
melting in the sun or something. you know what I mean?
Being destroyed by love.
Going back to authenticity for a moment, though, I want to ask if, you know, if the fact that this is a booming industry, the trend forecasting industry, and it is, and you could argue that it's booming also because people, these data aggregators have access to unprecedented amounts of data thanks to, you know, the digital storage of data and so forth. So they know more about us, they know more about arguably where we're headed, what we'll be thinking next year. Is there a danger that trend forecasting becomes too successful and that we start to lose sight of, we start to lose those wonderful moments in a culture where really original creative ideas come out of left field? They're not based on a trend. They're not based on a kind of midterm prediction. They're based on nothing like anything that we've seen before and they just emerge, bang, true creativity. I mean, are we in danger of losing that?
Oh, I think we're human and I think that we're always going to find those eureka moments. So I think that that's part of the fun of being a creative person as well.
But I bet you a trend forecaster won't find it for us. You know what I mean?
Well, yeah, maybe. I mean, you'll have to get them on.
You know, I always have this suspicion that someone's figured me out. And I remember walking into IKEA for the first time and going, oh, my God, they know me. I'm not sure I feel like that anymore. But it was a really spooky feeling, like people had done their research. And I think the moment I saw that very well articulated was in the film The Devil Wears Prada, where you might remember Meryl Streep's character, Miranda Priestly, the Ice Queen magazine editor, taking down the young intern who's played by Anne Hathaway. And Anne Hathaway's taking notes, who in this room, and they're trying, these fashion team are trying to make a decision between two seemingly identical aqua belts, and Anne Hathaway kind of sniggers, and then Miranda Priestly turns on her.
What you don't know is that that sweater is not just blue, it's not turquoise, it's not lapis, it's actually cerulean. And you're also blithely unaware of the fact that in 2002, Oscar de la Renta did a collection of cerulean gowns, and then I think it was Yves Saint Laurent, wasn't it, who showed cerulean military jackets? I think we need a jacket here. Mm. And then cerulean quickly showed up in the collections of 8 different designers. And then it filtered down through the department stores and then trickled on down into some tragic casual corner where you no doubt fished it out of some clearance bin. However, that blue represents millions of dollars and countless jobs. And it's sort of comical how you think that you've made a choice that exempts you from the fashion industry when in fact you're wearing a sweater that was selected for you by the people in this room from a pile of stuff.
From a pile of stuff. Oh, she's such a fantastic witch, that woman. But I do feel like that's what's happening to me most of the time, that what I end up doing, what I end up choosing to buy, what I end up wearing has all been sort of predetermined by some mysterious process I'm never part of.
And what's left of our taste? Do we even have our own taste? Who knows? Ultimately, though, trend forecasting is not going away anytime soon. It's going to get more effective and more pervasive. The best bet, I reckon, is to just remain informed and aware.
And try to figure out how to cynically make some money out of it.
Before we go, time to fess up and share what we've been obsessing about this week. What have you plucked out of the cultural ebb and flow? What's caught your attention? Suzanne Boccolate, first to you.
Well, I'm interested in the fabulous book marking site. It's like there's plenty of them around, but this one's called Supply, and it's a contemporary, I call it the contemporary version of hunting and gathering, and it's a way of me foraging the culture.
So how does it work?
Well, it's like an aggregator where you discover and buy products that you're interested in. You create these wish lists, so it's kind of like a Pinterest, but it's a little bit sexier than a Pinterest because it's designer wear and you can buy it.
So are you buying it? Are you
Yeah, I'm starting to. I put things on wish lists, and then you collect these things up, and then you become a forecast yourself.
And people follow you because of your good taste or crazy taste.
Yeah, I need to practice a little bit more because I seriously haven't got enough followers.
I think you're doing pretty well.
We'll put a link up on the website. Cassie, what are you obsessing about this week?
I've been following for a while on Facebook this guy called George Takei. Now, he's quite an old guy. He was a Star Trek actor, but it turns out he's got this real ability for visual humour, and people send him things and he puts things up on his Facebook page. He's got about 2 million followers and they're really funny. They're quite cute, often right on the money. But he's a very out and proud gay man and has been promoting same-sex marriage for some time now. And his response when Barack Obama came out, I shouldn't put it that way, when Barack Obama gave his in-principle support for same-sex marriage this week was really sweet because he'd been posting a few things about it. So if you haven't checked him out on Facebook, he's well worth a look because he's quite a giggle.
And meanwhile, my obsession this week, it's a brief one. It's an article by Melbourne academic Darshana Jayamana responding to film critic Roger Ebert's assertion that video games cannot be art because they're nonlinear, and he makes a great counter-argument to that. Really interesting article. And as I've just played Journey, which is a great video game, mentioned it last week on the show, I'm particularly interested in this debate, which goes on. Well, that's it for Common Knowledge this week. Thank you, Suzanne, for being our guest.
Thank you.
Yes, lovely to have you in. Suzanne Boccolate is the creative director of the communications agency Boccolate. And don't forget, you can follow us on Twitter at @RN_CK.
Of course, you can also find all the details about the show, including a whole lot of links to stuff we've been talking about on our website. You can also podcast the show and leave comments and subscribe to the RSS feed. Head to the Radio National website, follow the links to the Common Knowledge program page, abc.net.au/Radio National. Time to say goodbye. I'm Jason DiRosso.
And I'm Cassie McCullough. See you next week.
what young people are turning to technology for is to socialize, to hang out, to figure out how they fit into a broader social environment. The kinds of things that they do online are in many ways the kinds of things they have always done when they've gathered with friends. And what we see is that the internet in many ways mirrors and magnifies everyday life, good, bad, and ugly.
Young people and technology on Future Tense. Download the show from the RN website or look for us on iTunes.